You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
It's so nice to have an actual conversation about songs. I appreciate this.
Welcome to the 50th episode of Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, same old Sean. We've decided to celebrate today with a very special best of episode. We're taking a look back at some of our favorite moments from throughout the series history. From Nas talking about his deep relationship with Amy Winehouse, to Big Daddy Kane calling out his early producers, to Jean Grey's hipster spider, you'll be hearing some of the series' most memorable moments. Conflict and difficulty really bring out the best in people, and that's definitely been true on this show. The first clip I wanted to play was this absolutely jaw-dropping moment where Big Daddy Kane, apropos of nothing, called out Marley Marl for stealing production credit on his first album. This was quite a controversial clip, and in fact, I heard from some of Marley's people. And hopefully we'll have his version on a future episode.
It was the type of thing where, you know, at that time, you know, I was young, so I didn't know. I just was going by what I was told. And, you know, basically, like, you know, Raw, Ain't No Half-Steppin', pretty much everything off the first album except for Set It Off. Set It Off was actually done by Mark 45 King, and Marley did I'll Take You There. But, I mean, other than that, pretty much all that stuff is me.
Really?
Know? Yeah. Yeah, Half Step and Long Live the Kane, Raw, all that stuff is me, you know? I mean, Just Rhyme with Biz, we didn't even really do that at Marley House. I did that at my man Shemshon House in LG, Lafayette Gardens, you know, and just brought it to Marley House. But,
And then somehow the credits ended up saying something a little different.
Yeah, see, what I was told was, yo, you know, we got to deal with Warner Brothers because they look at Mr. Magic as the air personality that's going to play any of our songs because he's on the radio, and they look at Marley as the super producer. If they thought that Marley wasn't the super producer, we all lose the deal, and none of us would have no label. So, I mean, you know, it need to say produced by Marley Marl. I mean, don't worry, you're going to get your money. And my dumb ass, you know, like 18, 19 years old, I believe that. Okay.
So going from beef with a super producer to beef with a whole city, our next clip features Mystical. I spoke with him at South by Southwest, and he was talking about how he had a different style and sound than the bounce music that was popular in New Orleans at the time.
I don't give a fuck how well you can rap. They want to hear repetition, shake your ass and bounce that, bounce that, bounce that ass and whatever you want to say, you know, over the same beat over and over. If it didn't have that kind of chanty sound to it, yeah, they wasn't trying to hear nobody rapping. Right. I wasn't taking no for an answer. So that's why I had to kind of form a style to kind of appease to what they were liking, but still, you know, represent me and represent something bigger than just, you know, one market.
One of the other things I talked to Mystical about was his early 90s beef with Cash Money Records. Someone else who had beef with early 90s hip-hop was Abio Dune of The Last Poets. Biggie Smalls and Easy Mo B sampled Dune's cry of party and bullshit, which he used witheringly in his 1970 poem Niggers Are Scared of Revolution, while Dune's use of the phrase was meant to mock people who wanted to party all the time. Biggie's was celebratory. It's been 20 years since Party and Bullshit, but Dune is still upset. In this clip, he laments the lack of a political movement that would have kept Biggie in line.
I've also stated along the line, in the absence of a movement, the circus is in town. And this is what we're dealing with, a circus. And in the circus, you know, you got clowns. You got people who are standing out for just to make people laugh or just to get attention. And that's what's been happening because there is no movement. The movement kind of put people who weren't even in the movement in order.
Right. You started, you had the Black Arts Movement kind of in full swing.
Yeah. And so, but there's nothing now like it was then. Yeah. So consequently, you know, folks can get away with saying party and bullshit at a chant and not see the significance of it as it was meant to be. It bothers me when I see that, but it also gives me more fuel to recognize that I've got a lot of work to do. And so I do have a number, I have a nice amount of youth who I have the ears of all across the country, and I'm real grateful for the relationships I've established with some of our younger rappers and young sisters as well. And it just keeps me working. It keeps me recognizing that we have not reached the place that we need to be yet as a people, and that we still need to re-inspire and re-motivate, because things easily get twisted in America because of the financial piece, and whatever seems to be attractive can be prostituted.
That whole conversation with Dune was just a real eye-opener for me. I learned so much about the history of the past 40 or 50 years. Speaking of history, I got a different kind of history when I sat down with Sadat X of Brand Nubian. He shared his memories of growing up at Brooklyn's rough and tumble Albee Square Mall, most celebrated in the Biz Markie song of that name.
Well, first of all, the Albee Square Mall was like gladiator school. Like, that's why I said, like, a lot of, like, and I would never wanted to go back to them days. Maybe, well, in a way I would, but like, for you to go to Albee Square Mall back then, like, okay, they had the stores in there, and that was the spots, one of the spots in there you went to go get your gold teeth done. So when you went to Albee Square Mall, you was downtown Brooklyn. So that mean, first of all, you was dealing with the dudes from Fort Greene. They was right there, so they was automatically claiming that as theirs. Then you had dudes from Gowanus and them other places over there. They was like, well, it's only taking us about 5-10 minutes to get over there. So it was an amalgamation of Brooklyn tough guys, East New York, Brownsville. So for you to come from another borough to even step foot in Albee Square Mall, you had to be a gladiator. And it was just like, that was a time when hip hop, it wasn't safe, but it was such the lure that you were willing to bygone that. Like, I want to go so bad that I'm willing to pass the safety issues, and I just want to go. And Albee Square Mall, one of the places you go. And if somebody felt you wasn't thorough enough, they'd be like, well, yo, give me yours. And that's how it was.
While we're talking about New York and hip hop, no conversation on that subject could be complete without mentioning the Beastie Boys. When I sat down with Bill Adler, best known as Def Jam Records' original PR person, he clued me into a hidden secret of the Beastie Boys' success.
People underestimate Rick Rubin's influence on the Beastie Boys in terms not only of the records they made, but in terms also of their personae as performers and the entire kind of thrust, so to speak, of what they did. Rick's aesthetic at the time was, you know, he was a fan of Abbott and Costello, the slapstick comedians. He's a fan of professional wrestling, which is, you know, also very cartoonish. The Beastie Boys, I mean, say this, the Beastie Boys came to him with this name, the Beastie Boys, which, you know, is kind of perfect for what Rick envisioned for them. And they also came to him, you know, I mean, they had their bad boy inclinations, they had their humorous inclinations, but Rick is somebody who amped up all of that. And it turned out to be very, very potent, very attractive. They made a great album together, and then they went on out, and they had a year. 1987 for the Beastie Boys was like a year out of the Beatles' history before they, retired. The Beastie Boys were the biggest thing in pop music during that year, and it damn near broke the band up.
One of the most interesting things about this show has been that some of the best conversations have come not with artists, but with record people. You heard that with Bill Adler, and it happened again with Dante Ross. Dante is an A&R guy who signed just about every important rap act of the 90s. He discovered leaders of the New School and thus launched the career of Busta Rhymes. He found Brand Nubian. And he also signed a group called KMD. One of the members of KMD was Zev Love X. After Zev's brother Sub Rock died tragically young, Zev transformed himself into underground icon MF Doom.
So I knew Doom when he was really young, and Sub Rock, they were little kids, and he was a prodigy. You know, he was a child prodigy. He, at 17, he really produced Gasface. People don't know that. At 17, 18 years old, he was producing records for people. And Gasface, he did the drums on it, the whole shit. And no one knows that. So he was a prodigy, and so was Sub Rock. So, of course, you're going to see them grow and evolve and change. And because of circumstance, tragedy, as much as anything, he reinvented himself. And I feel like his reinvention was like... It has a lot of symbolic messaging to me. I mean, it's kind of like, I know it sounds like corny and shit, but it's kind of like the strength of Black America, like when I think about him. Because, like, you know, you could throw Black people a handful of shit all day long, but they're going to go make the greatest thing in the world with that handful of shit. You know, you could fucking X, Y, and Z, and motherfuckers are going to take that X, Y, and Z and make it something beautiful and incredible. So he got, his brother died, he got dropped from his label, and he turned around and became a bigger, more important artist on his own, in his own way, you know, following his own path by his own means. And to me, that's like he's a metaphor for the power of Black people.
Speaking of Dante Ross, the very first time I met him was in a recording studio with the person who appears in our next clip, DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill. Muggs talks about filming the video for Cypress's How I Could Just Kill a Man. A bunch of stars appear in the clip, and there are some secret cameos as well.
Q-Tip was just walking by. Yeah, it was a funny day because I think we invited Cube. Cube was in New York, Ice Cube. And we did it down in Astor Place where the Cube is, you know, the Cube down in Astor Place. And we called Cube. Q-Tip was there. Tim Dog was there, if you've seen him in the back. And it was funny because he had Fuck Compton, but there was Cube, Ike. And then Alchemist told me Prodigy and Havoc was young, like they were still in high school, I think, and they was there in the crowd.
The high school, as Muggs is referring to at the end there, Havoc and Prodigy, would of course in a few years go on to form Mobb Deep. Right around the time Muggs was filming that video, there was a young Jewish kid in suburban Maryland just starting to formulate a dream of someday becoming a big-time New York City radio DJ. Peter Rosenberg finally made it and remains amazed that no one got there first.
A, my entire life, I grew up thinking that there was going to be this white DJ who was going to come along before me and occupy the space that I currently occupy. And I have to say, I haven't thought about this in a long time, but it amazes me that it didn't happen. Like, it really blows, because I meet so many people, like you, I meet so many nonstop. I meet white kids who are as passionate and loving and knowledgeable and respectful of hip-hop as I am. You know, when I was young, I didn't want to admit that. I was like, oh, all the other white kids are posers. No. As time went on, I met tons of other white kids who truly are respectful of the culture and know it and could do well. Yeah. And somehow, I assume one
first.
Of those would also, you know, have maybe the gift of gab and entertainment value and be able to put together the package, and I wouldn't get there.
Yeah.
And somehow I did. And I cannot believe that in getting there in 2007, when you're talking about I wanted to be on Hot starting like 94,
right.
It's like so shocking to me that that didn't happen. But to be honest, it really hasn't happened since me either. I mean, there are other white guys out there who do a good job, and I'm not questioning them at all. But they still don't occupy quite the same space of being kind of funny and entertaining while really hardcore committed to like the cause of hip-hop.
Yeah.
And I think in that long answer is what I bring to the table for them.
Race has, of course, been a long-running flashpoint in hip-hop. A more recent one has been sexuality and sexual orientation. In this clip, Brother Ali examines his own changing attitudes towards these issues.
You know, I grew up not knowing anybody that was openly gay. not being close to anybody, you know. And I didn't have a particular hatred for gay people, I didn't think, but I didn't care about them enough to care about their situation or try to understand or anything like that. And so, you know, on my first album that I'm otherwise really proud of, Shadows in the Sun, I said that F word a couple times, not even referring to them specifically. Again, that's what I thought, you know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't realize, I wasn't, you know, informed enough or probably caring enough to know that saying that word as a synonym for weak or whatever adds to this big kind of cultural narrative that it's okay, that they're not, they aren't valuable and all that other stuff, and that they can be targeted and you know, tortured and killed and pushed to suicide and all other type of horrible stuff.
A word about that last clip. It's incredibly rare to find a rapper who is that self-reflective about anything, much less as controversial an issue as the F word. It was really great to talk to Brother Ali about this stuff. He's consistently been one of the artists most willing to challenge himself and his audience on just about everything. Our next segment is really special to me. Kevin Gates is just an incredible, powerful personality. And when I met him at South by Southwest, I was absolutely blown away. You'll hear a little bit of his magnetism in this next clip. He talks about his song Twilight. In the song, he talks about his first love, his middle school girlfriend, using the Twilight series as a metaphor for their relationship. The love between a vampire and a human turns out to have some surprising resonance in Gates' own life.
Metaphorically speaking, I feed on human beings. I feed on the energy of others. I feed, you know what I'm saying? You know how, like, when you meet a vampire, they need that person. You know, I need that person.
And that's how you felt about that relationship?
And that's how I felt about their relationship, because my whole life, I've always had abilities, such as physical abilities, such as mental capabilities, such as spiritual, you know, just abilities. I always had just abilities that made me out of the norm, so to say, when it came to just placing me in a, you couldn't categorize me with another group of individuals. And I really prefer not to be out in the daytime. And being that the world is more chaotic during the day, you know, at nighttime, everything's more settled, everything's more, you know, it's more peaceful, it's more me. So that's really where I'm at with that. And the men in my family, just genetically, we really don't age. After 25, we just get like, I can show you old pictures of me and I look older than what I was, what I look now. It's like some kind of way genetically we get younger after the age 25. My uncle, he looks 17.
In addition to Kevin Gates, one of the other absolutely captivating personalities I've had on the show has been Saul Williams. It was such a thrill to meet him. And the entire conversation with him was really mind-blowing. In this clip, he defends himself from some criticism he got for name-dropping Rand Paul's favorite philosopher and novelist, Ayn Rand.
I like Ayn Rand, all right, as a novelist. I like The Fountainhead. I like Atlas Shrugged. I don't give a fuck about the Republicans and even her objectivist philosophies and those who want to claim Ayn Rand for that. As an artist, like, if you ever read the journals of Ayn Rand and see the 12 years that she spent developing those characters and trying to put those philosophies into the mouths of those characters, it's brilliant. Just that, right? And I learned a lot about having integrity as an artist from studying Howard Roark and all those things and just, like, Frank Lloyd Wright and the whole idea of, like, right, the idea of this architect who's like, no, 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 I'm building the walls. No, 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 no. I'm going to decide what paintings goes on the wall. I have this idea. No, 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 trust me. And the idea of integrity that I wanted to have as an artist, I got a lot from those novels. I know I can get in trouble for saying I appreciate that stuff, but no, when I read Ayn Rand, one, it was before I ever knew that she had been, claimed by the right wing and all this shit. And I read it as an artist who was, and it was just like, wow, these artists are fucking hardcore. Some, you know, these are some artists who are like, you know, speaking about the struggle or what have you. Or there's a quote from Ayn Rand in Untimely Meditations, right. Ellsworth Tui, where he says, happiness is a mediocre standard for a middle class existence. Mm-hmm. Is a quote from that, you know? I refuse to let them own her, you know? I refuse to let her objectivist philosophy. I don't, fuck the philosophy, fuck all of that. I like artists with integrity. You know, and in that sense, I'm for it.
Just like Saul Williams talking about Ayn Rand, some of the most interesting moments on this show come when the guests don't talk about themselves, but about other people. When we had writer Adam Mansbach on the show, we took a good chunk of it to talk about his time drum teching for the legendary jazz drummer Elvin Jones, best known for his work with John Coltrane's classic quartet.
That was probably one of the most incredible musical partnerships the world's ever seen. The connection between those two, between the four of them in the band, him and Elvin and McCoy and Jimmy, was a phenomenal thing. But at the real core of the core was Elvin and John, in my opinion. And, you know, John had been gone for 30 years when I met Elvin, but it was still like a really painful thing. And he had a couple of stock public answers he would give. You know, reporters would ask me, say, well, John was an angel. And he just kind of leave it at that, because I think it was painful for him to go deeper. But he would sort of incidentally tell stories about John. And that was always when I really like paid close attention. You know, we'd be talking about stories about people missing planes or various travel wackiness. And that's when a story about John would come to the forefront and I'd be hearing some shit that was mind blowing, you know, like the time there was a gig in DC and there was a blizzard and McCoy and Jimmy were supposed to be on the second flight, but they missed it. And so only Elvin and John get to the gig and they start playing and like they're expecting the other guys to walk in at any moment, but they just keep not walking in. Next thing they know, they've played a 90-minute set and they take a break and they get back on the stage and they start playing again. And like, you know, Jimmy and McCoy walk in an hour after that and they're still playing and they try to come up on stage and Elvin won't let them. You know, he's like, we got this, like, get a drink, you know. I mean, shit like that, you know. As you can see, I could go on forever about this, so I'm going to shut the fuck up.
Another classic moment on the show was when we sat down with R.A. the Rugged Man and he reminisced about the transition that happened when his friend and collaborator, Christopher Wallace, better known as Biggie Smalls, passed early and became an icon.
People put all of us on pedestals like we're like super beings, you know. Biggie was just some kid that rapped in the neighborhood, you know. And I mean, it's a blessing the impact he made on society, man. I'm proud of the brother. I'm not saying he shouldn't be that, but I'm just, you know, these are people in your world. That's like, imagine this dude over here. What's your name again? Gabriel?
Yeah.
If Gavin all of a sudden is the fucking icon, you work with Gavin and Gavin's your boy, and all of a sudden Gavin's the biggest respected human being over, you'd be like, what the fuck is Gavin? Like, you don't think like regular, you know, you don't think of regular people like there's some above where the whole world is going to bow down to them. But, you know, that's why it was unbelievable seeing this dude Biggie that I knew and we were friends, and he'd call my house at 3 a.m. and, you know, we'd drive around my car and tell store jokes and play records for each other. And, you know, all of a sudden he's this one of the most iconic, you know, present people in the history of hip hop to society. Yeah. That's unbelievable to me. I love it, but it's you know, he's a regular ass dude.
This next excerpt is from when I sat down with Boots Riley from The Coup. Boots has long been one of my favorite rappers, and I completely bum rushed him with like rarities for him to sign, and I was kind of a mess. But we got to talking, and he told me about his relationship with Ice Cube. If you know anything about The Coup, you know that Boots references and quotes Ice Cube throughout his career and shows great admiration for him. He'd actually struck up a little bit of an acquaintance with Cube over the years, mostly at the artist's shows, and told us a great story about some unusual career advice that his mentor had for him.
After sometime right after Genocide and Juice, I remember he had a show with Goody Mob, and I went to this show at the Warfield, and I backstage again, And then he was like about to go somewhere, and he said, "Boots, come here. I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you." And he pulled me to the side. He said, "Your work is very impressive. Very impressive. There's no doubt in that. But what I need to tell you is, it's all about making that money." And then he turned around and walked.
So part of the reason that advice is so ridiculous is, especially if you've listened to Boots, which Ice Cube obviously had, you would know that he is a open communist and revolutionary. So telling him to put money first made absolutely zero sense. The next bit comes from my sit down with Derek Angeletti. Angeletti was part of the Hitmen production team that made so many classic Bad Boy Records hits. He was also best known as the Mad Rapper. But before he was mad at anyone, he went to Howard University with a certain Sean Puff Daddy Combs. In this clip, he reminisces about a student takeover that the Howard University students instigated in response to the school trying to name ex-Klansman David Duke to the university's board.
So we protested and we took over the administration building. All right, so news cameras, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, everybody got to come down. So we took it over, we put chains on the buildings, and these two girls who were, you know, remember Howard is this rebellion power to the black people, so you got people that were with it. So these two girls, we took over the thing, they went on their own and found the communication system that the security, all of Howard uses. So we can hear everything that they were planning to do. Mm-hmm. So we heard that they were planning on coming through the roof with helicopters, with tear gas, and they were going to come through the stairs of the roof and come get us out. Huh. So we went up first, and there's a picture of us standing on the roof before they got there with us holding sticks and chains and chucks. And it's a line of us standing on the edge of the roof of the administration building looking down. Somebody took a picture. Puff and his infinite wisdom took that picture and made posters out of it. So while we're in the building doing whatever, he's outside selling posters. So I said to myself, I gotta fuck with this kid.
Yeah.
It's something about this kid I gotta fuck with.
Right.
Because we worried about taking over the building, and so was he, because he participated, but yeah, he found a way to monetize it.
This next clip is really special to me. It's from our very first show with Jean Grey. I didn't really know what I was doing when I sat down to interview her, but her response and how it turned out really made me think that this show could be something. In this clip, she talks about the hipster arachnid who she briefly mentions on her song, "You Don't Like It, So What?"
Hipster arachnid, this is what happens to me. This is why I'm insane. That I immediately, when I wrote that line, I stopped. I have a creating character problem. So immediately, hipster arachnid became this entire character. I was like, we gotta do like a short on him or something. So in my mind, he's a giant spider. But he's got, you know, glasses on and a stupid fucking hat. And he wears ironic t-shirts. He tries to, but, you know, legs. Got a lot of legs. So he goes around Williamsburg and he spins, like, he spins these, like, intricate fucking web. And he does, like, he rips off like Picasso and stuff, and then he walks in and it comes back the next day and people are looking at it and people would be like, "That's amazing," and he's like, "Whatever, got over it." I mean, he was cool last night. And he's kind of a dick, but that's what happens when I stumble on lines like that. It never just stops at that line because I'm insane.
So we saved some of the best for last year. We've had a chance to talk to some really big names over the course of the show. Maybe the biggest one was the RZA, the mastermind of the Wu-Tang Clan. We talked to him about how the glory years of the Wu-Tang, when the group first came out and was cementing its legendary status, weren't all that much fun. For him, at least.
By the time I became the RZA, I had already gained a lot of knowledge and experience in life. And then I was actually trapped into a world where I had to grow up overnight. You know what I mean? I became the CEO of a company, a young millionaire, a guy that had to guide the lives of 8 other brothers and careers and make sure they had what they needed for they could grow and prosper. I had to make contract deals and politic my way through the industry. And I spent years of not having fun. You know what I mean? And if I count the years, I remember from 1992 up until about 1998, I was probably one of the most serious men on the planet. You know what I mean? I was, my strive and my drive and my ambition was just super focused, yo, and my persistence to win. But at the same time, during that period, Wu-Tang is getting famous. We're going platinum, double platinum, Method Man's double platinum, and they're getting all this pussy, having all kinds of fun. They're buying cars. I'm only buying more equipment, investing into building up our company and stuff. You know what I mean? They're coming out with new leather coats. I got the same old jacket, the same old boot. If you look at some of the old videos, I actually look ugly.
I don't believe it.
Well, I'm glad, you know, your fans respect me. But if you look at it, you'll see my style wasn't totally together. Maybe on a few videos, I went and got my style together. But I'm known in my neighborhood as a stylish dude. I'm the guy who had Gucci sneakers before anybody, polo suits and all these things. But when I became the RZA entity, this workman who had to complete this job, I let all that go. I didn't care about it.
Next up is a short part of my conversation with Taleb Kweli. I've been a huge Kweli fan since the earliest days of his career and was really thrilled to talk to him. I noticed when I was listening back through his catalog to prepare for this conversation that he used 3 words over and over again, and they were revolution, love, and spiritual. I asked him what each of those 3 words meant to him.
Revolution is change, and change is something that's extremely spiritual to me, and that change is God. You know, what we're dealing with constantly is change. And even with my career, you know, and the type of artist I am, people, my fans a lot of time want to go back in the past and back to old school and back to the way it was and back to the origins of hip hop. A lot of them don't even understand what the origins of hip hop are, to be so demanding and insistent that we go back to the origins.
Yeah.
But it's important that I recognize the trends and I recognize the changes and I remain myself in that. And it leads into the spirituality thing, because I truly believe that at the end of the day, that's what God is. God is that which creates change. And so I think the spiritual question is something that on different levels we all deal with. Everyone has their own way of dealing with it, but we're all constantly thinking about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Just some people are charged with having to express what people think, and I'm one of those artists. And then love, I mean, I think that's the whole reason why artists even do music. You know, even the most hardcore rapper really wants to be doing a love song. You know, we want to talk about love. That's the driving force behind why we do it. We want to be loved. We want to talk about love. We want to be in love. And, you know, that's why underground rap fans, in order to not be soft, underground rap artists, in order to not be looked at as soft, they don't make songs about busting a gun. They make songs about how much they love hip hop, you know, and it's just really about love.
Another music legend who needs no introduction is Ron Isley of the Isley Brothers. The man has had hit after hit since 1959, but is best known to most hip hop fans for playing the character of Mr. Big in a number of duets with R. Kelly. The best-known moment of their collaboration comes at the end of the song Contagious, when Isley sings about needing to leave before he catches a case.
You know what? I have to admit this. When I sang this song, I didn't know what catch a case meant. And I would do it on the stage, and everybody would scream. Now, it was screamed, you know, I said, what are they talking about? Catch a case of collapse? Are they talking about what would catch a case? Then I realized, then it was a funny way when that came up to me and said, hey man, catch a case for me? You catch a case in jail. You know, you catch a case, that means you got to go to jail. You caught this case. Maybe that should be something I shouldn't even tell, you know. And so, I mean, R. Kelly just laughed to his head, like, you know, just fell on the floor laughing.
We close the show with one of the greatest ever to do this hip-hop thing, Nasir Jones, known to the world as Nas. When we sat down with Nas in LA, we talked about his whole career, but the part that really stuck out was when he spoke about his relationship with the late Amy Winehouse, with whom he shared a birthday.
I mean, how cool is it to meet someone who you share the same birthday with, who's a great artist?
Yeah.
When does that happen? That doesn't happen too much. So I think that was the connection overall. And then on top of that, I didn't get a chance to really know her that much. I knew her through music. I knew her through Skype. I knew her through texting. I knew her through telephone. I knew her through hanging out one time in London, like one trip in London, just hanging with her. But, you know, I met her through Salaam Remy. And the greatest thing in the fucked up thing is that the greatest thing and the thing that's sad is that I met someone who shared my same birthday, who we had no competition, we had no beef, we had no tension, nothing like that. It was just we always knew we were supposed to be cool. And that's as far as it goes, you know. She was like a sister to me.
Thanks for listening to this very special 50th episode of Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. A big shout out to everyone who's helped on the show since the beginning. There's just too many of you to name. Doing this show has been an absolutely incredible experience, and I wanted to thank each and every person who listened. It really, really means the world to me. Also, a special thank you to all of the people who have appeared as guests on the show. You've really been incredible. Picking this best of was hard, and I left out so, so many things that I wish I could have included but couldn't for time's sake. So a big thanks to everyone, and definitely keep listening, and we'll keep staying outside the lines. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
And it was just like, wow, these artists are fucking hardcore.
This monster of a show was produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
So, I mean, you know, it needs to say produced by Marley Marl.
Special promotional help this week from Julia Hannafin.
Passionate and loving and knowledgeable and respectful.
Our music is by Psionic.
At 17, 18 years old, he was producing records for people.
Join us in 2 weeks when we talk to Umar Ben Hassan of The Last Poets. We'll see you then, Outside the Lines. Welcome to a very special episode 50 of Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
Like a special episode of Different Strokes when...
Yeah.
Rudy gets touched.
You know, we've been watching Family Ties, and we actually skipped over the like creepy uncle episode with Mallory from the first season. I just couldn't bear it.